This is the 11KBW Employment Podcast, where every month members of our employment team get together to chat about a recent case. I'm Oliver Jackson, and today I'm joined by none other than our co-head of chambers, Dan Stillitz, KC. He's going to tell me about the EAT decision in Peepenbrock and London School of Economics. So what was the issue in Peepenbrock?
So Peepenbrock, taken at its simplest, is a case about whether the Employment Appeal Tribunal has the power to grant an anonymization order in respect of a person who is a non-party to proceedings, to which the answer is yes, it does, even though it doesn't have such an express power. But the case is interesting for a few reasons. One is because it illustrates how the rights of the individual, which might be prejudiced, are weighed up against the principle of open justice and the right to freedom of expression, which always has to be treated as a countervailing factor in determining whether to make anonymization orders. And also because it's facts, it's fairly lurid and graphic. We know what the public wants, so
let's give them the highlights.
Okay, so this is a case which is a heady mix of academics, economics, stalking, and allegation and counter-allegation in the high-octane world of management studies. We'll come to the detail in a minute, but it's a rather unpleasant and unseemly case, I'm sorry to have to tell you.
There's quite a lot to unpack there. So the principle of open justice, what's that?
Okay, so it's a fundamental principle seen as part of the lifeblood of our democracy that court proceedings take place in public. And sometimes it's summarized in the phrase, justice must not only be done, but seen to be done. It's important for a number of reasons, some more obvious than others. Obviously, if justice is dispensed behind closed doors, there's much more possibility of abuse. It's not transparent to the public how justice is dispensed. It's not always clear if it's being done fairly. There are also practical reasons. For example, in the criminal context, it can be important for proceedings to be in open court because that may impact whether witnesses come forward and things like that. Specifically in relation to naming parties, the rationale for the principle of open justice isn't quite as obvious. The way it's been put by the Supreme Court has been to say that if one doesn't name the individuals involved in a case, it's simply much less interesting and the public just won't take as much notice of it.
That's very pragmatic of them.
Yes, and you know, not completely self-evident to me, but the Supreme Court said you need to trust editors to decide what information should go into reporting matters, and it actually should be attention-grabbing. People should pay attention to what goes on in court. As I say, I'm not sure that it's completely coherent, but that's the basis on which actually naming people is seen as part of the principle of open justice. But more generally, the important point is that, you know, the courts shouldn't operate behind closed doors. If people are asserting claims against one another, they should know that it's in a public forum. And in general, the information that is put forward in the context of court proceedings will go into the public domain.
That seems quite a strong principle and a strong interest. What tends to weigh against that in the balancing act that you mentioned?
The principle of open justice is a common law principle, which has been developed over many centuries. It also is derived from two articles of the European Convention of Human Rights, in particular Article 6, the right to a fair trial, which also says that civil proceedings should be conducted in general in public, and also Article 10, the right to freedom of expression, which not only is about being able to express your views, but also to be able to receive information and form opinions based on it. So that's where the sources of that side of the equation are. What is the countervailing factor in most cases is Article 8 of the European Convention, which is the right to private and family life. In reality, Article 8 has developed a more generalized right of privacy, which in some cases is sufficiently strong and sufficiently liable to be prejudiced that the court will intervene by a number of routes. The most obvious one is by anonymizing individuals where otherwise their Article 8 privacy rights would be prejudiced.
How come that doesn't happen more widely? Sort of what is sufficient to trigger this Article 8 outweighing these other principles that you mentioned?
Well, in theory at least, the presumption is that everything is in public and there's no anonymization. Any restriction from complete open justice has to be justified. That's the onus is on showing that it's sufficiently serious. And so even if there are embarrassing allegations, personal information, and that kind of thing arising in proceedings, which is very common, particularly in employment litigation, that's not enough in and of itself to justify anonymizing. It has to be something that would be genuinely impinging on the right of the individual, and not only that, but sufficiently strongly impinging on it to outweigh the countervailing principles of open justice, Article 10, freedom of expression, and so on.
In the employment tribunal specifically, how do these principles manifest themselves?
Peterborough was an EAT decision. We'll come to the specifics of that in a minute. But normally this issue arises in the employment tribunal. And it's governed expressly by Rule 50 of the Employment Tribunal Rules, which provides in terms that there's a power to make anonymization orders. It also provides that one has to give full weight to Article 10 and the principle of open justice, and essentially says that a balancing exercise has to be undertaken. In practice, there are really two scenarios where anonymization orders are sought. The first is where very personal or lurid or scandalous allegations are raised in the context of proceedings. Very often, one party or the other will make allegations of sexual misconduct, financial misconduct, criminal misconduct, things which, you know, can be very damaging to the reputation of an individual. And the case law shows that reputational damage very much falls within the ambit of Article 8 of the Convention. So where one has these sort of serious and unpleasant allegations arising, as we'll see, did arise very much in the Peterborough case, if you're in that sort of scenario, then often you'll find that the parties themselves or witnesses, or as in this case, a third party who's features in the background to a case, will seek an anonymization order on the basis of those allegations being made against them. The second area where it frequently comes up is in relation to commercially confidential information. For example, in equal pay cases or discrimination cases relating to bonus, it may be that individuals don't want their salary or remuneration more widely to be disclosed, or that their employer doesn't want it to be disclosed. Sometimes information about clients is perceived to be particularly sensitive, and employers don't want that to be disclosed. However, whilst a lot of applications are made on that basis, interestingly, it doesn't on its face fall within the principle under Rule 50 of the tribunal rules, in that it's not really commercial information doesn't in general go to Article 8. It doesn't go to one's private life. I mean, it's an interesting question. Does it go to one's right to privacy, how much one earns? You know, I think that's debatable.
Lots of people would probably regard that as quite private, the amount of their salary.
Equally, we know, because it's on the public record, what a lot of people earn. So, you know, we know, if you look at all the strike action going on at the moment, you know, we know what train drivers earn, we know what nurses earn. So, you know, it tends to be the richer people who see it as a more sensitive thing, in my experience. And equally, information about clients, now that may be very confidential from a commercial point of view, but the clients that an investment bank has, that doesn't really go to anyone's Article 8 rights at all. So where one's seeking to redact or anonymize that kind of information, it's much less clear-cut that the principles that we're talking about today are really in play at all.
So you're clear that Article 8 and these anonymization orders can't help much for commercial information. What can clients do to try to protect their commercial information?
There will be some occasions when one can try and bring commercial information within the ambit of Article 8, but generally it won't be possible. There are other things one can do. I mean, very often tribunals are sympathetic to arguments based on relevance and, you know, where there is no obvious purpose at all, for example, naming clients. They will put a lot of pressure on the parties to seek to agree anonymization keys and that kind of thing. It's not really obviously based on any legal principle or particular tribunal rule, but there are authorities on it, and in general, they are encouraging of the parties being, I suppose, responsible about that kind of thing. So there are ways of doing it, and from a respondent's point of view, again, it can be quite an effective tactic, essentially to try and paint the claimant as being opportunistic and acting for ulterior reasons if they press too hard for resisting anonymization in a commercial context. Because again, if you turn around to the claimant and say, well, why do the names of the clients need to be there? It's quite hard to explain why it's really necessary. And so one can use moral pressure as much as legal principle to your advantage in those cases.
We should now get to the facts of Piepenbrock. So Piepenbrock, we've trailed this quite hard. It's quite a lurid case. What were the facts?
Yeah, it's quite an unpleasant case in many ways. Dr. Piepenbrock was indeed is an academic at the London School of Economics. And things started to go very badly wrong for him when an ex-student who came to be employed by the LSE as well made allegations of harassment against him. You know, he had mental health issues and went off sick. But his big mistake was to sort of decide that attack was the best form of defense. Now, that may apply in rugby and boxing and some other fields, but in litigation, it's not always the greatest idea.
It's a high-risk approach.
It's a high-risk approach and a risk which, in his case, very much did not pay off. So having had this young female academic make allegations about him, he sought to go on the offensive and made some very serious allegations against her. In particular, he alleged that she had stalked him, harassed him. The most extreme allegation was that on a work trip, she exposed herself to him, all of which was subsequently found to have been completely untrue. But his way of turning the tables was to say, no, it wasn't me harassing her. It was she who was harassing me. I was a happily married man. And she turned, you know, she made my life hell.
Which is a slightly difficult allegation to make when he also set up a website about the whole issue and made various allegations on that about her.
Yeah, he went very much all in and set up a website about her with pictures and so on. It was pretty obviously malicious and frankly a bit unhinged, the whole thing, but very serious because she was a much younger and necessarily vulnerable individual. And, you know, as she told the tribunal, was very, very distressing to her, as one would imagine. So the question came to this. He brought a whole series of claims against the LSE, not just in the employment tribunal. He brought a personal injury claim in the High Court. He later brought a defamation claim in the High Court.
Why were his claims brought against the LSE?
So he brought claims alleging he'd been discriminated against in various ways. And in the context of that, those proceedings, he again made these very serious allegations against the third party, the woman who's referred to as Ms. D in the judgment. Again, he made these very lurid allegations against her. And this illustrates why anonymization can be so important, because employment tribunal proceedings, like all legal proceedings, are subject to absolute privilege. So you cannot be sued for defamation for anything you say in the context of legal proceedings, or indeed on any other basis. So it can be a cloak for, you know, very unpleasant, untrue allegations being aired with impunity, which is essentially what Dr. Piepenbrock sought to do in this case. And that's why it was so important that the question of anonymization was decided. I mean, in my experience, it is not uncommon for litigants to seek to use the cloak of absolute privilege to make scandalous allegations as a way of trying to get their employer to settle cases. So I've been involved in many cases where there have been some, say, whistleblowing allegations or discrimination allegations made by the claimant, and they find a way to chuck in a whole load of other stuff about how their employer tolerated all sorts of bad behavior, and they put in witness statements saying that senior managers were involved in drug taking, you know, illicit sex, illegal activity, taking bribes, anything you can imagine. And they feel they can do this because however outrageous the allegation and however untrue the allegation, you can't be sued for what you say in the context of legal proceedings. Now, in those cases, it's possible to seek anonymization orders. There are other things you can do. You know, I've often applied to get whole reams of allegations struck out on the grounds of being scandalous.
I guess that's probably route one. You try that one first.
Yeah. You know, if in the most extreme cases, that's the obvious route. But, you know, more subtle individuals will put things perhaps in a slightly less extreme way, but nonetheless say things that their employer or managers or colleagues will not want to be aired in public. And it can be, you know, if it's done skillfully, it can be difficult to distinguish between what is a genuinely relevant allegation on the one hand and a spurious and scandalous one on the other.
And in Piepenbrock case, how did the EAT approach this problem?
So in the EAT, there was a prior question, which is that whilst Rule 50 of the Employment Tribunal rules governs when one can make anonymity orders in the Employment Tribunal, there is no equivalent to it in the EAT, which is a bit odd. And I have had a situation once where we got an anonymity order in the Employment Tribunal. There was then an appeal. And we had to scrabble around to say, well, how are we going to stop it all coming out in the EAT when we've worked so hard to avoid it coming out in the Employment Tribunal? But there are now a number of cases which make it clear that essentially the same principles apply. And that's really for two reasons. The first is that under Section 30 of the Employment Tribunals Act 1996, the EAT has a general power to govern its own procedure. And it's been held in a series of EAT decisions that power is wide enough to import the power to make anonymization orders that applies in the Employment Tribunal. In addition, you don't really need that because the Employment Appeal Tribunal, like all courts and tribunals, is a public authority under Section 6(3) of the Human Rights Act. And as a public authority, it's bound under Section 6(1) of the Human Rights Act to act compatibly with convention rights. And where it is said that it would be a breach of someone's Article 8 convention rights not to anonymize their name in the EAT, then EAT must be under a duty to make an anonymization order, having conducted the full weighing up process that is bound to do, in particular in relation to the right to freedom of expression under Article 10. So in this particular case, the EAT, adopting a belt and braces approach, felt it had both these routes to having the power to anonymization, even though there's no express power under the EAT rules for it to do so.
And both those routes, the language of Rule 50 in the EAT rules and then the other route potentially under Section 6 of the Human Rights Act, in practice lead to the same analysis. You end up with the same balancing act, is that right?
You end up with exactly the same balancing act, which is one which is very fact-specific. In this particular case, it has to be said, it was not a very difficult balancing act to undertake because on the one hand, you had this young woman who had been, you know, grossly traduced by these horrible allegations, which would be very detrimental to her reputation, which had, by the time the matter came before the EAT, been found by the Employment Tribunal to be wholly untrue and indeed malicious. So you had these malicious, untrue, scandalous allegations on the one hand about a young employee who was not a party to proceedings, who was now living abroad. And on the other hand, you had the claimant who, when pressed by the EAT on, well, why are you so against her name being anonymized? All he could say was that he had a very strong belief in and commitment to the principle of open justice, which it has to be said, in context, sounded a bit hollow. And certainly Judge Shanks, who decided the case, thought it was.
Did it really matter that the allegations were untrue in this case? Could you have a case where an anonymization order is made, even though the allegations are true?
Yes, although that would be part of the balancing exercise. I think it really put this one very clearly on one side of the line, the fact that these been found to be untrue malicious allegations. I think where you've got a case where serious prejudicial allegations are made which are peripheral or irrelevant, then you've still got a good chance of getting an anonymization order. And this is where there is a bit of a disconnect, I think, between the theory and the practice of how this works, because in principle, the right to freedom of expression takes primacy, the principle of open justice takes primacy. Mrs. Justice, similar as she then was when she was president at the EAT, gave a couple of very trenchant judgments saying that, you know, the presumption is very much against making anonymization orders. And she also made the point that the principle of open justice isn't something that one can needs to show a particular prejudice in respect of in the individual case. It's a principle of general importance, which always weighs in the balance. But the reality is that it's much easier as an advocate to demonstrate the seriousness of prejudice to an individual's Article 8 rights than it is to bang on about freedom of expression and open justice. And that's because you can say, as the LSE could in this case, look at this individual. This woman is going to be really seriously prejudiced if her name is not anonymized. And, you know, it's not very difficult to, it doesn't require much imagination on the part of the judge to see that. When you're resisting it and you say, well, open justice is very important. Well, yes, it is, but it's quite difficult to sort of articulate that in a way which is as persuasive and tangible and vivid as the prejudice to the Article 8 rights of those in respect of whom it's being invoked. So whatever the theory, my experience is that the courts are more ready to make anonymization orders than you would perhaps expect, not requiring an awful lot. They tend to be in practice applying the principle, does it really matter if this individual's name is anonymized and what's the downside for them if it's not, rather than my starting point is open justice, is there a very strong case for anonymization? So there is, it seems to me, a little bit of a disconnect between the theory and the practice. Not in this particular case, because it was such a strong case on its facts.
So as employment law practitioners and litigators, what practical points should we take from this if in future we're thinking about potentially applying for an anonymization order?
Well, I think if applying for anonymization orders, the key point is to make the prejudice to the individual's Article 8 rights as tangible as possible. Now, in this particular case, Ms. D wasn't involved in the proceedings in the EAT at all. But interestingly, the LSE's lawyers obtained an email from her where she set out in a very compelling way why it would be severely prejudicial to her if her name was not anonymized. And that was a sensible thing to do, because if one doesn't either have a witness statement or an email or a letter or some basis for asserting the prejudice to Article 8 rights, the difficulty is that one may be met with a tribunal saying, well, you're asserting that this individual's going to be prejudiced, but I can't simply assume that. Where's the evidence? What's the basis for me to interfere with this fundamental principle of open justice? So I think if you're applying for an order, the more one can put flesh on the bones and really show that it's a serious interference with Article 8, which will impact the individual in a fundamental way, the better. So that's the practical point to take on that. I think from, if you're resisting the allegation, I think it's important to try to get across that it's not a resistance that is being asserted for improper purposes. Because it will often be the case that the reality is that the resistance to anonymity orders is part of trying to embarrass the other side. It's part of trying to perhaps get them to engage in settlement discussions. And it could be quite hard to put an attractive argument. But I think what one has to do is simply say that there's you know, there is a presumption in favour of it. It's not to be done lightly, and that they haven't met the requirements of it. Now, it's difficult where there's very salacious allegations involved. It's much easier to do that where one's dealing with the sort of commercial confidence issues which we discussed earlier. So to take an example of individuals being identified in terms of what they're paid, one can say, well, that's simply a consequence of employment litigation. If you're involved in employment litigation, information about individuals' terms and conditions, remuneration, is going to come up routinely. There's nothing that inherently impinges on individuals' Article 8 rights by disclosing what they earn. It's, I think, perhaps a lot of people find it unseemly or, dare I say, un-English to sort of talk about money or talk about how much people earn. But, you know, there's equally an argument that pay transparency is very important in combating discrimination in pay and so on. And so, you know, I think to try and demystify that and challenge some of the assumptions underlying it is one way to resist applications for anonymization in that context.
So I guess the final question that I want to ask you is that I'm aware that there's been a recent European Court of Human Rights case that, while not in the employment tribunal sphere or the employment sphere at all, is quite striking and quite a reminder of the risks to people's livelihoods when they aren't anonymised, when stuff goes wrong. What was that case?
Yeah, about? That's the case of SW and United Kingdom, which is very much on topic for this because it was another case of a third party who was referred to prejudicially in proceedings. Now, these weren't employment proceedings. They were care proceedings where the applicant to the Strasbourg court was an expert social worker who'd given evidence in the context of those proceedings. The judge had made some extremely serious allegations about her in the judgment, including that she'd lied, that she'd behaved in a way that was potentially emotionally abusive to a child, really serious stuff, particularly for a professional social worker. And they'd been given no opportunity to respond to the allegations. This just came out in the judgment and was horrific from their point of view and very, very damaging to their professional reputation.
The judge also directed that this judgment with these criticism in it should be sent to her employer and her regulator.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a, you know, very inappropriate and extreme response to not having liked the evidence that was given. And the appeal courts in the UK had something to say about that. But it was taken all the way to Strasbourg, and Strasbourg found that it was a breach of Article 8 rights to do this. And, you know, one can see why, because otherwise, under the cloak of the privilege of proceedings, people's professional reputations can be really seriously damaged. And when they're not a party, they don't even have a formal right to answer them, and they don't have to be put to them because they're just a witness. Now, it does raise an interesting question as to whether an individual who's not a party can actually appeal a judgment that is critical of them. I looked at this recently. I think they probably can, but it's not completely obvious what the route to doing that would be. But it just underlines why, where one's dealing with third parties, sometimes anonymization is not only an option, but really essential in order to protect third parties.
That's quite interesting. So going back to Piepenbrock, if the, very unlikely on the facts of the case, as we've discussed, but if the LSE hadn't got the anonymization order, Mrs. D, you think, could have potentially appealed it on that basis?
Yes, I think, I mean, it may have been too late, but it seems to me, certainly in the Court of Appeal, if you look at the rules for the Court of Appeal, they don't confine an appeal to the parties below. And given that Ms. D would be saying my Article 8 rights have been prejudiced, and the Court of Appeal is a public authority as well, which needs to comply with convention rights, it seems to me there'd be at least an argument that she could have herself gone to the Court of Appeal and sought to get the order. Of course, as always with reputational matters, timing is of the essence. And so if it's already out there, it can be very difficult to put it back. But interestingly, the authorities also make clear in terms of anonymization orders that simply because information has already been aired in open court doesn't mean that one can no longer use anonymization to protect Article 8 rights. So there isn't the principle of, you know, once mentioned openly, that's it. There's still a balancing exercise to carry out, and anonymization can still provide some protection, even if there's been some sort of leakage of information which it prevents.
That sounds a little bit like trying to put half of the genie back in the bottle after it's gone, but it's probably fair on where that actually happens in those cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a difference between something just being there for everyone to see and something where someone has to do quite a bit of research to find out somebody's identity. I think there is a genuine distinction to be drawn there.
That was Dan Stillitz-Casey talking to me about Peepenbrock and London School of Economics. You can subscribe to the 11KBW Employment Podcast on all the usual podcast apps. You can also email us at employmentpodcast@11kbw.com.